Sean took a handful of mud from the bank on which he sat and smeared his bare arms and face. He crawled under a dense bush on the bank and watched the hind come sweeping in over the treetops, banking in a wide circle around the burning hulk of the Hercules, and then hovering like an evil vampire 200 feet above it. The flames reached one of the fuel tanks, and the Hercules exploded in a dragon's breath, scattering pieces of itself across the river, the flames hissing into steam as they hit the water. The hind hung over the river for almost 5 minutes, perhaps searching for survivors, and then abruptly it rose high, turned its nose southwards, and dwindled to a speck against the blue. "Limited range and endurance," Lark the man said. Sean stood up from his hiding place. "Now, go home like a good little Ruski and report the target destroyed. Go tell Bobby Mugabe that he doesn't have to worry about his precious stingers falling into the wrong hands." He reached into his top pocket and brought out the packet of Dutch cigars. The cardboard disintegrated in his hands and the leaf had dissolved into a soggy porridge. He tossed it into the river. "Tama gave up anyway," he sighed, and trudged along the bank, heading upstream. Job was working on the two injured troopers. "This one's got a nice set of cracked ribs and a broken collarbone," Job finished the strapping and then indicated the other patient. "I left this one for you." "Appreciate it," Sean grunted, and examined the broken arm. "It's a bloody mess."
"Nice adjective," Job agreed.
2 inches of the shattered humerus protruded from the dark bruises and blood clots. A buzzing swarm of metallic blue flies were circling the clots, and Sean brushed them away.
"What have you done so far?"
"Given him a handful of painkillers from the med box."
"That should stun an ox," Sean nodded. "Get me a piece of nylon line and 2 of the strongest Shanganis."
The arm had shortened dramatically, and Sean had to get the ends of the broken bone to meet again. He looped the nylon rope around the trooper's wrist and gave the ends to the Shangani strongmen.
"When I say pull, you pull, understand?" he ordered.
"Okay, Job, hold him."
They'd done this before, often. Job took up his position, sitting behind the patient, and slipped his arms under his armpits and locked them around his chest.
"I'm going to hurt you," Sean promised the patient, and the man stared back at him impassively. "Ready?"
Job nodded, and Sean glanced up at the rope.
"Pull!"
They laid back with a will. The injured man's eye snapped wide open. A rash of sweat droplets like blisters burst out on his skin.
"Pull harder,"
Sean snarled at Ferdinand, and the arm began to elongate. The sharp point of protruding bone withdrew slowly into the flesh. The Shangani ground his teeth together in the effort of restraining himself from screaming. The sound was like 2 pieces of glass being rubbed together forcibly, and it grated along Sean's nerve ends. The point of bone popped back into the swollen purple wound, and Sean heard the 2 ends rasp together deep in the flesh.
"That's it! Hold it!"
he told Ferdinand, and deftly placed 2 splints from the first aid box along each side of the arm. He strapped them in place with surgical tape, binding it up as firmly as he dared, without cutting off the circulation, and then nodded at Ferdinand.
"Slowly. Let it go."
Ferdinand released pressure, and the splints held the arm straight.
"Another breakthrough for medical science," Job murmured. "An elegant and sophisticated procedure, Doc."
"Can you walk?" Sean asked. "Or do we have to carry you home?"
"Of course I can walk," the trooper was indignant. "Do you think I'm a woman?"
"If you were, we would ask a top bridal price for you," Sean grinned at him and stood up.
"Let's inspect the loot," he suggested to Job.
It was their first opportunity to examine the crates from the Hercules. There were 35 of them, piled haphazardly under the spreading branches of an African mahogany. With Ferdinand and four of his men assisting, they sorted through them, stacking them neatly after noting the lettering on each. 33 cases, each weighing 154 pounds, were marked. Stinger guided missile system. One, grip stock and antenna. One, interrogator. Five, loaded launch tubes. That gives China 165 shots, and there are 11 Hinds left in the squadron after the one you knocked out of the sky. Sounds good to me. With the way some of these beauties shoot, they are going to need every one of them, Sean grunted, and then his expression of deliberate pessimism lightened. Well, well, here is one for the book. One of the two remaining odd-sized cases were stenciled. Stinger guided missile system. Training set M-134. Tracking head trainer. That will make somebody's life a lot easier, Job agreed. The captured manuals had discussed this training system, which allowed an instructor to monitor a trainee's tracking technique during a simulated missile launch. It would be invaluable equipment for whoever was given the job of teaching the RENAMO troops to use the system. However, it was not until Sean examined the last and smallest case that the full value of the prize dawned on him. The small wooden crate was stenciled, Stinger Guided Missile System, Post-Modifications Software. Sweet Trinity, he whistled. It's a post, not a common or garden system, but a ruddy post that we've got ourselves here. Let's take a look. Job was as excited as he was. Sean hesitated, like a child tempted to open his gift before the dawn of his birthday. He glanced up at the sky, looking for Hinds. Strange how he'd picked up that nervous habit from his Shanganis. We don't move until dark. Plenty of time to kill, he capitulated, and leaned over to draw the bayonet from the sheath of Ferdinand's webbing. Gently, he prized open the lid of the crate and lifted away the slabs of white polyurethane packing. The software was contained in a heavy-duty plastic carry pack. He sprang the catches on the lid and opened the case. The dozens of software cassettes were each color-coded, sealed in transparent glassine envelopes and fitted into tailored slots in the interior. This was what they'd read about in the manuals they'd borrowed from Carlyle, the British gunnery officer. Get the manuals, Sean told Job. And when he brought them over, they squatted beside the open case and pored through the heavy volume which described the post system. Here it is. Hind attack system, color code red, numerical code S42A. Under the post system, the Stinger missiles could be programmed to attack various targets by employing tactics and search frequencies specific to that type of aircraft. Simply by inserting one of the microcassettes into the console of the launcher, the missile could be instructed to alter its attack technique. System software cassette S42A. Job followed the text with his forefinger as he read aloud from the manual, is targeted on the Hind helicopter gunship. The system employs a two-color seeker, which registers both infrared and ultraviolet emissions in two stages. The initial stage will lock to infrared from the engine exhaust system. The Hind's exhaust suppressors divert and emit those infrared rays through heavily armored outlets below the main fuselage. Missile strikes on this section of the Hind have proved ineffective. The S-42A modification automatically switches the guidance system of the Stinger into ultraviolet seeker mode when range 2 target is reduced to 100 meters. Ultraviolet is emitted principally from the air intake ports of the Isotov TV3-117 turboshaft engines. This area is the only section of the fuselage not encased in titanium armor plate, and missile strikes through the engine intake ports have resulted in 100% kills. To achieve effective ultraviolet acquisition, the initial launch of the missile must be made from below and dead ahead of the aircraft at a range not exceeding 1,000 meters nor less than 150 meters. Job closed the manual with a snap.
Big casino, he said. China is getting more than he ever hoped for.
There were 30 heavy cases to carry, and only 20 uninjured men, including Sean and Job. Sean cached the boxes that they were forced to leave. He would send a detail back to fetch them once they reached the Renamo lines. Carrying what they could, including the trainer and the post-modification equipment, they set out along the bank of the Pungwe River at nightfall, groping for a contact with the Renamo front line. They marched all that night. The extended column, slowed down by the heavy cases of missiles, covered only 12 miles before sunrise. However, the weather had changed, and the wind had backed into the east, bringing in low cloud and a cold drizzle of rain that would hide them from the searching hinds. They kept going all that day. At dusk, Sean let them rest for a few hours, and they huddled miserably in the rain until Sean roused them once again, and they stumbled on, slipping and sliding in the mud and cursing the loads upon their backs. An hour after sunrise, the clouds rolled away and their sodden battle dress steamed as it dried on their backs. 2 hours later, they ran into the ambush. They were moving through light savanna along the river bank. The flat-topped acacia thorn trees were interspersed with clumps of coarse elephant grass. Sean heard the metallic snap of the loading handle being jerked back to cock a machine gun, and before the sound had fully registered in his brain, he was diving forward, shouting a warning to his Shanganis. As he hit the sandy earth with his elbow and belly, he saw the muzzle flashes shimmering and dancing like fairy lights in the grass only 30 paces ahead, and a blaze of shot passed over his head, making him blink and flinch. He rolled left to throw the gunner's aim, holding the AKM with one hand as though it were a pistol, firing blindly to further confuse the attackers and groping for the grenade on his belt. He was on the point of hurling the grenade when behind him Ferdinand shouted a challenge in Portuguese, and the firing from the front shriveled and died away. From the patch of elephant grass just ahead of Sean, a voice replied to the challenge, and then Ferdinand was shouting urgently in Shangani, "Cease fire! Cease fire! Renamo! Renamo!" There was a long, suspicious silence, during which Sean kept his right arm cocked back, ready to throw the grenade. He had seen too many good men called out to die in a false truce. "Renamo!" a voice from the front reiterated. "Friends!" "All right," Sean shouted back in Shangani. "Stand up, Renamo. Let us see your beautiful, friendly faces." Somebody laughed, and a grinning black face under a tiger-striped camouflage cap popped up out of the grass and ducked back immediately. After a few seconds, when there was no more firing, another man stood up cautiously, and then another. Sean's Shanganis came to their feet and moved forward, slowly at first and with weapons cocked. And then they were meeting in the open ground, shaking hands and laughing and slapping each other's backs. They had run into the sector held by the battalion under the command of Major Takawira. He recognized Sean immediately, and they shook hands with mutual pleasure.
"Colonel Courtney, what a relief to see you alive. We heard on the news from the BBC and Radio Zimbabwe that your aircraft had been shot down in flames, with you and all your men wiped out."
"I need your help, Major," Sean told him.
"I've left 20 cases of missiles cached out there in the bush. I only want you to send a detachment of 100 men to fetch them in. One of my men will guide them to the cache."
"I'll send my best men. I'll pick them out personally," Takawira assured him.
"How far are we from General China's HQ?" Sean asked.